and welcome to Future Library. This is, I'm not even going to bother trying to remember what number this is. It's in the high 20s. But I've recorded so many of these listeners in the last few weeks that are all kind of coming out over a period of weeks that I'm kind of losing track of where I am with it. Obviously not the most interesting thing for the listeners to know, but I like to tell you listeners what's going on because it's, I think it's important, but it probably isn't important. But so today is a bit of a different one for me because it's the morning again. The last time I did this was when I was speaking to Gary Marshall about his album. If you remember that episode, any listeners that are regular listeners, I'm using the word listeners a lot, aren't I? Listeners. Yes, listeners, I am. Any regular podcast tuners in will remember that one. We spent about 5 minutes talking about his album and about an hour and a half talking about something else altogether. So that's maybe what happens with morning podcasts. But at the moment, it's for me, it's just after 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. Which is just inhumane, to be honest. I should be asleep. But for my guest, who you can hear laughing in the background, it's a different time altogether because I believe my guest is in Tokyo. Is that right?
It's true.
There you go. See, this is partly why I wanted to do the podcast today, because I was telling my wife last night that I thought it was quite exciting to talk to somebody who's in Tokyo at the moment.
It's exciting for me as well.
There you go. And obviously, at the end, when the podcast comes out, you're probably not going to be in Tokyo. But anyway, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves here. I've not actually introduced my guest yet. My guest is somebody I could have... I can't even remember how I stumbled across her music online. I think it was on some blog mentioned it. And I went and had a listen because I was intrigued by the kind of ASCII art for the cover. Really liked what I heard. Performs under the name 33... Oh, no, I'll start again. It performs under the name $3.33.
$3.33.
$3.33, there you go. So I'm giving the long name there, you see. See, I'm British, that's what we do. So $3.33 with a dollar sign at the start.
Right.
And it's... I don't know, there'll be links to all this at the end in the paper. Not in the paper, why am I saying paper? In the printy stuff at the bottom of the podcast where you look to find information. You know what I mean, listeners. It's early in the morning. Stop complaining. And also, yeah, so we're recording this before Christmas, but by the time it comes out, it's after Christmas, so Christmas was very exciting, wasn't it, listeners? Ooh, and that big event that happened, or didn't happen, oh, can you believe that, or not believe it? So, yeah, anyway, Celia, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I have to apologise for my slightly more rambling and incoherent than usual state today. Not only is it very early, and I've had very little sleep, but what little sleep I did have was interrupted by a lot of coughing and a head cold. And luckily, I'm not coughing at the moment, because that would be make the podcast almost unlistenable. But yes, Celia, tell us a bit about yourself, rather than me just making stuff up.
Not sure where to start. I've been recording music for the past year under the name $3.33 or $3.33. The last two albums I made were recorded in Marfa, Texas. And right now I'm currently in Tokyo.
Why are you in Tokyo at the moment?
Well, my boyfriend and I moved out of Marfa after living there for over a year. And we just got back from Shikoku Island in Japan, where we were doing the Shikoku Henro Trail, which is a Buddhist pilgrimage that visits 88 Buddhist temples around the island. And although we planned to visit all of the temples, we ended up only visiting three of the four prefectures. And so that's 65 out of 88 temples. And yeah, we ran out of time, basically. So right now we're in Tokyo before we go back to the U.S.
See, for a second there, I thought you were going to say, you know, we only did three or four of the temples.
Oh, no.
And I was about
Although
to say...
we could have.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's
there
crap.
There are many...
three or four out of 88, that's not very good.
And we gave up.
And then you're going,
but
they're all the
so
same.
Many temples.
Are they all very similar?
Examples that we could have, we understood how people, no, they're all very different.
Ah, I see.
There are many that we understood how people could spend a lifetime at one. So I could understand just going to three or four, but yeah, there are many. And we didn't quite make it to all of them. And we were walking in between each one, so it's a very exhausting experience.
So Tokyo then, is it as alien as people say it is?
It's definitely very different and foreign and very exciting for me to be here. I've wanted to come visit my whole life. I wouldn't use the word alien, but very stimulating and often confusing and dense.
You see, I could have imagined it as being, whenever I see it on TV or something, I imagine it as being the closest to being able to be either on another planet or in the future as you can get without actually leaving the Earth.
I think underwater, deep sea would be the closest to going outer space or maybe the future.
Yeah.
Deep sea.
You think deep sea is nearer to being a... Well, I'm kind of thinking not so much in outer space as in, like, in the vacuum of space. I'm kind of thinking maybe on an alien world. And I mean alien in that way, not as in, like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
You know, like another planet where, you know, a super advanced civilization is living. and maybe, I don't know, maybe Tokyo is the nearest we've got to that kind of thing on Earth at the moment. They do seem to be living in the future, the people of Tokyo.
Yeah.
Well, that's the impression we get, isn't it?
Yeah. especially after, right after Marfa, Texas.
Yeah. Is Marfa the place that's got the kind of high fashion store that just sits on the road somewhere in the middle of nowhere?
It is.
Yeah. I can't remember who there's.
There's an installation of a Prada store that's outside of Marfa, about, I'd say, like an hour and a half drive outside of Marfa, in between Marfa and El Paso, near Valentine. It's in Valentine, Texas, actually. And it's just a Prada store, fully stocked, actually, with shoes and maybe bags, and lights are on at night, and it's just, it's there in this nearly abandoned ghost town.
Yeah, it's just it's one of these things that if any
and gets vandalized,
that's I think that's unfortunate.
And photos taken of it. A lot of people pose in front of it and get their photos taken.
If anybody,
or they jump in front of it. Actually, there is a recent trend while I was living in Marfa, started by Beyonce, where she Instagrammed a photo of herself jumping, like, fully spread out with all of her limbs in front of the Prada store, and then right after that. I saw this trend emerge of people jumping exactly like her,
like, and then star posting jumping kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, starfish.
And it is literally, if you look at it on Google Earth, it's literally in the middle of nowhere. It's a very odd thing when you first see it that it looks like it should just be in a middle of a very busy high street. And it's just sitting there in the middle of nowhere. And especially odd when you see photographs of it at night. And it's just sitting there all lit up with the display in the window and the fully, it's just a shop. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
It's just sitting there fully stocked. But so that's where
it's very desolate, but it's definitely not the middle of nowhere.
it seems that way. Maybe I haven't zoomed out far enough on.
Yeah.
You know, I've zoomed out, like, you know, a foot, and went, oh, that looks desolate. There's nothing next door to it. Oh, it's like the middle of Australia.
It's the desert.
You see, I think something like that would be really good if you put it in the middle of Australia, if you put it somewhere where there wasn't anything for 1,000 miles in any direction.
Right.
That would be good. Not even on a road, just sort of just sitting. Maybe there is something like that. Maybe it's just maybe somebody's made it and we don't even know about it. Maybe there's
a Prada store exists in the desert in Australia, but there's no one there to see it. Does it really exist?
Yeah. Does it sell bags? I kind of imagine that there's probably a fully stocked Apple store sitting somewhere in the desert in Australia.
That'd be cool.
With no staff.
I didn't know I don't know that much about Australia. I didn't know that there are thousands of miles of nothingness and desert like that.
Everybody just lives on the edges in Australia.
Oh.
Nobody lives in the middle.
But it's small.
Australia?
Yeah, right?
Australia's quite big.
And for... Chosen.
let's find out. This is live looking up for the listeners. Australia, let's see how big it is.
Well, small is relative.
Small is relative, yeah. I mean, it's a continent in its own right, so...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's as big as the continent... I can't remember what it's called. Is it Antarctica at the South Pole? Yeah, it's as big as Antarctica. And it's... let's see.
Hold on one moment.
Okay.
Sorry.
I can hear bells. Are you wearing bells?
No. Hold on.
Okay. I'll tell the listeners while we're holding on then.
Hi, I'm taking a phone call right now.
Okay.
I'll be out soon. Thank you.
AirPods.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much. Hi. Sorry about that.
Is somebody trying to take you to the airport?
No. We're staying in my boyfriend's family friend.
All right.
Was generous enough to give us a room in his apartment, and he was giving me information about how to get to the airport.
Ah, I see. I see that again. That's something that this is what you don't get on other podcasts, because other podcast listeners, that would have been cut out, but you're hearing that. That's a slice of life there. Australia, 7.6 million kilometers, square kilometers. It's the sixth largest country in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very big. But everybody lives on the edges because the inside is a furnace of uninhabitable desert with insects that would tear your face off rather than look at you.
And vacant apple stores.
And a vacant apple store somewhere there. You see, I want to start this rumour now. I think we now have to start telling people that, like the Prada Marfa, there's a vacant Apple store fully stocked.
Yeah.
That they, let's make it even better, this story. Let's tell people that not only is it fully stocked, but occasionally they helicopter out new stock to replace it whenever new things come out.
Right.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Yeah, that's the story. So, listeners, that's what's happening. In Australia, somewhere in the desert, there's a fully stocked Apple store, and you can just walk in. The door's open.
We can make a website for it and Photoshop a good image of it just kind of float that out there into the world and see if someone goes looking for it or if it grows.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea. I think that's something. I think there we go. There's a joint project. We'll work something out. The problem is that Apple would probably sue people for making fake websites of them. But then I guess you could say, no, it's an art thing.
Or they might. If it becomes very popular and trendy, it could be interpreted as an advertisement for them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Of course, people might go looking for it. And then we might be responsible for deaths.
I know. That might be very scandalous.
Yeah. I'm just going to cough. Hang on a second. I'm just going to turn my mic down for a moment. That's good. I've not done that too much all the way through, so that's good so far. Considering how much I was coughing last night. Anyway, so you've been making music for, you said, about a year and a half, you say, under the
3.33.
Yeah.
It's easier to say than $3.33.
You see, I keep on wanting to say 33 and a third, because I keep on thinking...
You should just go for it. You should say that then.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be right, because it should be 3 1/3, shouldn't it? Rather than 33 and a third. I keep on thinking of the speed of a record. So 3:33. Oh. So when you started doing that, I mean, the music itself, I recommend that everybody go and listen to it. And obviously I say this every time that I interview somebody, I recommend going and listen to it. But the reason I do that, listeners, is because I wouldn't be talking to people if I didn't think they were good. So I know it's a bit redundant of me to say go and listen to it because, automatically we should assume that you will. But yes, do, because it's good. It's... there's one album called, it's slightly hard to pronounce a row of punctuation. There's four short dashes, three long dashes, and then four short dashes. That album's got lots of titles that are either opening brackets or closing brackets in different kind of, almost like wave forms, which is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of really, really restful to look at. And then the other one is called Dollar Sign. With a with a full stop or a period after it. So how do you refer to these albums, Celia? Just so you know.
Honestly, I refer to them as the first and second under that name. But I would say the first one would be like $, empty $, and the second one, I don't know, I guess I don't refer to it that much in speech.
It's the one with the kind of ASCII cloud on the cover.
Lines,
yeah, that would work. It's really, I really like it. I like that it's kind of this...
Thank you.
Sort of chopped up. Sometimes the tempos kind of change towards... I mean, I think this one track... I listened to them a lot when I first downloaded them. My brain's a bit fuzzy this time of morning. But I think there's one track where the tempo changes quite dramatically as it goes along. There seems to be a nice sense of unbalance to them. Mm-hmm. Is that a deliberate thing that you've tried to, or do you, because I mean, you may well be, and I'll come back to this in a moment, you may well make music the same way as I do, but I kind of want to hear what you say about what you do first to see if, you know,
I am really interested, as most musicians are, in time, and I studied gamelan for a little bit and have always loved listening to gamelan music, and one of the main reasons after listening like more deeply is that the time signature is very, very fluid and changes a lot, and the patterns or structure will stay the same, but then one of the main variables will be the time, and it'll kind of like wax and wane and expand and contract, and that's definitely something that I'm interested in doing, like within my own songs.
So, I mean, I think it's this, because in the kind of brief kind of email conversation we had before this, as far as I understand, when you put this stuff together, do you kind of live sample yourself playing and then chop it up, or are you kind of generating a lot of sounds with the computer in the first place?
That's kind of exactly what I do. I usually play, like sometimes I'll like play piano for about an hour and use a field recorder to record it, or a microphone, and then I'll put it into Ableton and then kind of either chop it up or like treat it in different ways or stretch it around or kind of like roll it until it becomes indistinguishable from like what I recognize it as in the first place. And then we'll make clips out of that like treated material.
I think Ableton's fantastic for that kind of thing. I mean, it's my main tool for doing my stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'll have to send you a link to some of my stuff afterwards so you can have a listen, because I think there's certain similarities.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the things, I mean, that I do is that it's a lot of it is, how can I describe it? It's, again, it's sitting and playing or finding recordings of things I've played. And then I take, with my current stuff, which I'm performing under the name A Small Glass Ghost, I've discovered the joys of the little kind of drum pad thing in Ableton and making kind of drum patterns from that. Because I always used to, for years and years and years, I wasn't aware of that. So I used to make all my drum patterns in an emulated Windows drum machine running on my Mac.
Okay.
I used to use this thing called Leaf Drum because it's the only thing I could find that I could pull samples into from other things. And it was a real fiddle because it was running under this thing called Crossover. So it was running a Windows thing on my Apple desktop, and it was all a bit awkward.
Right, right. Like and then parallels I just, or something. Yeah,
absolutely. And then I discovered that I could actually do it straight in live.
in Ableton.
Yeah. Then I felt a bit like an idiot. Yeah, I felt like a bit of a fool for not having realised this, because I mean I've been using Live since 2004, I think.
Oh, cool.
I started with Live 1 on a second-hand Wall Street PowerBook, which is a 1998 model.
So how's Ableton Live evolved from Live 1 to 2013?
Weirdly, it looks exactly the same.
okay.
Because
not surprised.
I think they cracked the way of getting it to work fairly early on with it. There's a lot more automation now. And a lot more things kind of work properly, and you can render the whole thing, which you couldn't do in the first version. You couldn't render to disk the whole track. So I remember the at the time when I was doing it, I was doing a project called The Moths, and the album I was doing for that was an album called Nature. And I did it was the first album I'd done, which it was kind of partly recorded with an old Roland 8-track, digital 8-track that recorded on zip discs. And it was partly recorded on a PC and partly recorded on my my PowerBook. And I remember the album itself, about 45 minutes long, 50 minutes long. And the way I'd made it was all the tracks ran into each other. So I had to put it all together in the session
and then
view.
Render it as like one.
Well, I couldn't render it. That's the thing. I had to record. I had to record it out of the headphone socket of the PowerBook into my mini disc player, and I had to sit for the full length of it, all the fades and everything manually.
Right.
And
just
then,
like waiting until the end, and then like
And then I had to import the audio into my knackered old PC where I had Audacity running. Because the PowerBook didn't have USB ports or anything. It was all SCSI. It was so old school. So I then had to export it into this PC and then chop up the files. It was a whole faff. And now I don't have to do that anymore, which is really nice. So that's one improvement. Obviously, Max has become part of it.
I love that process, though. It just sounds like so tedious, or like this little packet of stuff, like going through all these different digital infrastructures.
Yeah. I'll tell you something, though. The worst part was, Celia, if you got to the... I did one pass through the album, and I made a mistake in the last five minutes of it. So I couldn't just redo that one little bit. I had to go back to the start and do it all again.
Yeah.
Good God, that was painful.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, yeah, I like it much more now. I mean, I'm using Live 8. I've not upgraded to 9 yet. And as a result of using Live 8, I'm kind of still sitting using Mountain Lion. I haven't gone up to Mavericks yet on my Mac because apparently the latest version of Live 8 isn't fully compatible with Mavericks yet. So I'm waiting. I keep on checking to see if there's been an update. Apparently there's one coming that will make it compatible, but... Yeah, but mind you, I had Ableton 5 running on Lion when I had it, and that was supposed to not run at all. So I recorded a track at the time called Officially Impossible for the project I was doing at the time, because it was supposedly not possible to do it because that software wasn't even meant to run. So, but yeah, because I use Live so much, I don't want to risk it all falling over if I upgrade. So.
Right.
I'm waiting. So, while we're talking that, what's been your experience of Ableton?
Well, I made the Dollar Sign album was my first like experiment with using Ableton, and it was a really interesting process because I think for a long time before that I was kind of I'm intimidated of using software for recording music. And so that album was my first like real effort in just like delving into it. And it was, and continues to be really fun. But I think, I don't know. I also wrote a small essay when I put that album out. And a lot of it had to do with like my experience of using Ableton in the beginning and that learning curve. And I'm still very much a beginner, but it's a very powerful tool and its capacities are enormous. And I felt like the weight and the threat of, I think what was threatening about it kind of was sometimes like when I was first like experimenting with it, just feeling like, things, the products that I was making were sounding more like something that Ableton made and less like something that I was using Ableton to express myself through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a negative thing. I'm just like aware of like its power.
Yeah.
And how easy it is to like kind of lose yourself in like these grooves that Ableton has set up for users, and also like my resistance to that and trying to like maintain or trying to continue learning how to use it so it can be a tool for expression, not as much just like, I don't know, like a DJ platform or something like that.
I think the thing that's really good about it is that once you've got your head around it, it's quite easy to use it your way, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's the thing, that's why I've stuck with it. I mean, I've tried various other things. I mean, I had an experience a few years ago where I was using a cracked version of Ableton 5. And I was in the middle of putting together a kind of techno record with a friend of mine. And I thought I was going to go over to his house one evening to, we were going to go, you know, do some more work on it. And I could have thought, just before I go, I'm just going to put this one beat back where it should be.
I'm really scared. And then it disappeared.
No, well, what happened was it suddenly, I went to move the beat and it suddenly went, copy violation detected. And it wouldn't let me do anything more with it. And I was like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding. So I tried uninstalling it, reinstalling another cracked version, and that's it. But it had worked flawlessly for about 2 years.
Right.
And it's something we've talked about on the show before, is that there's a rumor amongst Ableton users that what's actually happening is Ableton sending out these versions into the world that are fully functioning versions that are cracked, that are set up so that they have a sort of time limit on how long they'll work for. And it can be 6 months, it can be a year, it can be a couple of years. And the idea is that you get so, it becomes so much
in love.
Yeah, it becomes such an essential part of your...
You evolve with it as a cyborg.
Yeah, that you then have to buy it. Luckily...
Well, why wouldn't you just buy another cracked, download another cracked version?
I think for some reason it just doesn't work. The next cracked version you download doesn't work.
Oh, so what happened? What happened was... Did you buy it?
I did. That's the short version. I ended up buying it.
Oh.
But luckily, because it was when Live 7 was coming out, and I was still using Live 5, and one of the music shops in the UK was selling a Live 5 bundle for £195. So me and the guy... me and the guy who were doing the techno record together went halves on it, and... You know, and that came with a MIDI keyboard, so he got a MIDI keyboard because I already owned one. So for £100, I got it. And then, very nicely, a chap called Henry had stopped using his version of Live. So when I upgraded to my new Mac, he signed over his copy of Live 8 Suite to me. So that was really nice of him. So, yeah, so I now have legitimate versions of Live. I don't know.
So you don't have to worry about it, crumbling under your feet.
No. Are you using a legitimate?
Any random point.
Yeah, are you legitimate or are you using a cracked version?
I am using a cracked version. And I think that kind of started because at first I wasn't sure if I even wanted to use Ableton.
Yeah.
And so I... But... You know, trial version is so limited.
Yes.
So I downloaded a cracked version, I think among others, but Ableton was like pretty quickly my favorite.
Yeah, I think that's what they count on.
But I do kind of expect any moment, any moment I'll open up my program and it'll just be like, this does not exist.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't...
This is not valid and everything that you've made is lost.
Well, the thing is, all of it's still there and you're able to use all of it still. And you're able to play it in the demo version still. So that's, you know, don't worry about that. What will happen is that eventually, it may be, and it may be a really long time till it does, and it may never happen, or it may happen tomorrow, or in a second's time, or whatever. There's no way of telling. Basically what happens is at some point, I think it reports back to the Ableton mothership. And because I used to turn off my Wi-Fi and everything when I was using it to make sure, to make sure that it couldn't contact anything to check. Because I knew that Photoshop used to do that. It used to report home.
Right.
And, you know, you don't know. So I used to always turn the Wi-Fi off before I even launched it. and all this kind of stuff. But it's still the robots found me in the end. But I think the weird thing is, when it happened, instead of me going, oh, I'm never using Ableton again, and trying to find something else.
It's just like, I need this.
Yeah. And
you
I also
can't
thought,
take this away from me.
Yeah. And I also thought, you know what? Fair enough. Fair enough. You know, it's worth the money that they're asking me for. So
basically, the theory is that they have seeded out these trial versions that just have a longer lifespan, and you don't know that they're trials.
Well, something like that. I mean, there may be no truth in it whatsoever. But, you know, because I like to
I don't know. It's interesting to consider, and it's like a slightly more like benevolent theory in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it's a wave. I think if they are doing that, it's a genius piece of marketing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're going to have that happen, if people are going to rip off your software, and you may as well use it to your own benefit, because either the people who wouldn't have used it anyway will stop using it after a short period of time.
Right.
And the people who become completely kind of absorbed in it are going to need it. And when it goes south on them, they're going to be like, oh, right, I've got to pay for it. When I was talking to Joe Howe, who used to play under the name Germlin and now plays in Ben Butler and Mousepad, and he's done a couple of records with Momus. And when my live died, I kind of said to him, has this happened to you? And he said that he doesn't know anybody who hasn't ended up having to buy live on the Mac. He says that everybody he knows started out with cracked versions, and they've all ended up buying it.
Wow.
And he said, if anything, it's cheap. If you've got the money to spare, he said at the time, just buy it now. Don't even wait for it to die. Just buy it and get it over with.
It's inevitable.
Yes. And their support's pretty good. And the thing is, if you've got one of the most recent versions of it, when they upgrade, you can upgrade fairly cheaply. So,
yeah.
You know, and obviously all the upgrades within that version are all free as it goes along. So, but that's quite a lengthy advert for Ableton there.
And I'm starting to think that maybe this podcast is just an advertisement for Ableton.
I'm employed by Ableton. Yeah. I tried other things when it went
more
wrong.
More genius advertising.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I don't even know that I'm employed by them. That's the thing. So they've not even told me. They don't pay me.
Exactly.
It's just the way that Ableton works, and there's a little bit of script in the software that makes people do this. There's a part that little thing flashes up every now.
Yeah, just staring into that screen.
Yeah.
These subliminal messages.
Yeah, they just flash up saying
continuously.
Podcast about the software. Tell your friends. It keeps on flashing. Yeah.
Well, it is very tremendous and mighty.
Yes.
And I'm really thankful for its capacities and how deep it is, and how long I'll be able to use it and continue to be a beginner.
Absolutely.
Tom Blaine.
Yeah, it grows with you. That's the thing. You know, as you learn how to do things with it, you know, as you want to do things, you look to see if it can do them, and almost without fail, it can. You know, and especially now having Max built into it, if it can't do it, you can find someone who's written some third party thing for it that can do it. So, it's great. So, so you've been using Ableton, that rather circuitous route we've got back to, obviously, I mean, it's a good tool for playing live. Are there any intentions for shows?
That's an interesting question. I guess I don't perform that much. I played two shows in the past year under this name, like with this material, and I have no pressing plans to play anymore. Maybe if I'm invited or if there is an event that would be really interesting to play.
How did it go down live? How did people respond?
It was great. In the past, I've not enjoyed playing live, or at least in solo alone, have not enjoyed playing alone. And these two shows were really different because I thought they're very productive and a good way for me to share music for one of the first times. And I think I got good responses. So that was really gratifying to get some feedback. But they're also different in that, and since it was also the first time that I'd like composed all this music using Ableton, I was faced with the challenge of how to present this type of work that isn't like live music in the traditional sense, obviously. And it's also not electronic music in the sense of like a DJ who has a beat and then drops different vocal tracks on top, or like mixes in different patterns, or, you know, fades in and out. I mean, that whole world is actually really abstract to me and so far from what I do in my process. And all the music that I've made have been like, have turned into these like crystallized objects, or like final crystallized compositions or paintings almost. And then performing, like I don't want to just like press play, obviously. So for the past two performances, I've, kind of worked with, well, the last one that I did, I played in Austin, in the summer, and I was one of three openers for Dem Dyke Stare, which is exciting for me. And I made a composition before that, worked with the second song on my second album. And yeah, this is where it gets complicated because I can't refer to like names in any clear way, but the like Lines album, the second song, which is, I think it's about 7 minutes on the album, but for the show, I created a version that was very extended and like really got into all the like nooks and crannies of the song and lasted for, or could last for about half an hour and, with different sections and parts of it that I could play keyboards over, and parts that I could like do a live mix of. But, and I also got really into making visuals and creating films for the shows as well. Which was really fun, but so different from other shows and definitely a challenge because there's always the question of like, is this, like, what is true improvisation? Like, what is a dynamic piece? Like, am I, like, faking this to people by doing... And I don't think I am at all, but it's... I don't know, there's this tradition of playing a show and this pressure to entertain and, you know, this want to be, like, transparent and genuine in, like, your sharing of... your work, but maybe I'll play a show again. I haven't thought about it for a while.
It is difficult when you're doing stuff with a laptop, I find, because I mean, I found my experience has been that you sometimes see people who just seem to just press play and then stand around checking their email behind their computer. Whereas
they're playing.
You could have walked around and they're, you know, they're playing Doom or something like that.
Yeah.
And, or kind of just surfing the web idly, looking at Amazon or something. And occasionally dancing and waving their arms in the air while they're doing it. You know, and at the same time, we're typing with the hand, yeah, dear mom, I'm playing a show right now. How are you and dad? It has been a good week. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas my attitude towards it is I use Ableton. This podcast brought to you by Ableton. I use the live view in that, and I chop up all my tracks. Well, the way I make them, they kind of end up being little kind of MIDI clips made up of samples of what I've played. Render all those parts individually and then to a folder and then pull them all into a grid. So I can then work, and I have them laid out in columns all the bits for each track, plus a bunch at the end that are just kind of kick and snare drums, so that I can have kind of beat going all the way through. And then I kind of just work through it, and I kind of improvise and put parts from one song against another part. And when I play live, it's a lot more kind of dancey sounding.
Right.
Because it, I think it...
It's also more engaging.
Yeah, I think you have to, from my point of view, I feel that I have to do something that will pull people in a little bit more. Because if I just play the tracks as they are, some of them seem really slight on my last record.
Right.
And I think, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think for a live situation, some of them wouldn't work as well. So I think it needs to be a slightly more kind of forward moving and a bit more kind of propulsive, and you know, so that's the way I do it. But I find, again, sitting there genuinely improvising with the software, deciding which clip to use, deciding how to treat that clip on the fly. It's kind of almost as hard work as playing guitar in bands was years ago and things like that. So,
I mean, for me, it's probably harder.
Yeah, because there's that whole muscle memory thing, isn't there, with things like playing guitar? Because I remember playing, I remember playing gigs with kind of indie rock bands years ago, and getting through the whole song and playing guitar and singing, and having not thought about the song at all.
Yeah, not even knowing that it happened.
Yeah, and getting to the end of the song, have we done that one already?
Too.
You know, and like, you look at your set list and you go, sure, have we just played that? And they go, we have played that. Yeah, I don't know.
Or you're totally.
Yeah, or you're thinking about, you know, what do I need to do when I get home? What am I doing tomorrow? You know, whereas with this, it's so much more involving because you're having to actively make decisions. And there's no muscle memory at all. It's just, so it's, so for anybody who thinks that playing with a laptop's easy, it isn't, listeners. it looks easy, but it isn't easy.
Right. Or it can be easy.
It can be easy if you're lazy.
Right.
But, you know, I think, you know, people who are not lazy, it can be quite, it's very involving, and you get to the end of the set and you feel like, thank God that's over. That's really tiring. But the great thing about it is you can record it as you go along. You set another channel up just to record it.
Yeah.
And you've got a fully mastered kind of stereo.
Like piece.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then you go, yeah, I'll stick that up on Bandcamp. Took a couple of quid on that one. You know, so that's good. So you also do lots of other things. Your website is slightly difficult to understand when you first go onto it. It's CelioRayHollander.com. And for people who first go to it, they're faced with looks like a couple of tildes and then a row of a row of punctuation.
Right.
And that's it. I like that myself. I like the whole kind of sparseness, and I like that it's kind of carrying over the aesthetic of the album titles and stuff. Or maybe it's carrying over your aesthetic from before that into the albums, but.
More in that direction.
Yeah, so what led to that? What made you decide that was the way to go with... What's caused you to...
With that design?
Yeah, that very kind of sparse...
I haven't checked it for a while, to be honest, but and every once in a while it kind of, like, bugs and changes its arrangement, but unless it's still how it was before, it's kind of, like a... basic emoticon for a crying face.
Ah, yes.
Oh, so yes. With many, many tears.
Yeah.
Not to sound too emo, but if you do like a if you tilt your head, you can see the like form of the eye with like all the teardrop commas and then the parentheses is enough.
Yeah.
So I don't know, not a high concept design move, just an interest in like those forms and using emoticons in that way.
And then when you could click on them, it takes you to pages.
Right.
About stuff and about art and...
And different projects that I've done. I think all the projects on my website under my name have to do with visual art or architecture installation. And then like my music page is pretty separate.
Yeah. So, I mean, so did you come at it from being a visual artist in the first place, or did the two things kind of happen at the same time over a period of years, would you say?
Happen at the same time and hopefully influence each other in tandem.
Mm-hmm.
I've been recording music since I was 15. Although it was always on like a digital four track and pretty casual, and always just something that I did on in my spare time, very slowly, and then every once in a while would release an album, but only to my friends. And I studied visual art and architecture in school, so...
So you mentioned briefly that, you know, your familiarity with playing stuff on guitar. Did you start out kind of doing more kind of structured, almost kind of rock music, would you say, or?
Probably not. I'd say my music has been always, like, all the music that I've made on my own has been pretty poppy, but, like, lo-fi or kind of experimental with, like, with pop songs and using, at least in my earlier recordings, like the instruments I had at hand and very acoustic. And I, for the record, I would say that piano and keyboards are my main instrument and like the only instrument that I'm really fluent in.
Yeah.
And synthesizers. And then I play some guitar, but, I feel pretty limited in that. Like I feel like I learned how to play guitar very fast, and then I kind of plateaued and didn't have like that much interest in continuing.
No, I can relate to that. But, you know, I taught myself to play guitar, and after about 3 years, I felt, right, I know enough. And
likewise,
you know, started playing in bands and reached the point where I could kind of, you know, rip off a kind of Jay Maskis style guitar solo if I needed to, but mostly what I was doing, the way I played guitar was I played through a lot of effects and really liked the sound of having two or three distortion pedals chained, and that kind of super saturated almost the gaps between the chords being louder than the chords kind of thing.
Right.
And lots of uncontrollable feedback coming out and stuff. My youngest son, who's now, I think he's 15 now. It's his birthday the other day. I should know what year it is. It was born, shouldn't I? He's a way better guitarist than I am. He's technically very, very good. Cause he's kept on practicing. Cause I genuinely reached a point where I was like, right, I know enough. I don't need to know anything more. I can play songs on this. I can write songs on this. I can perform with it. I don't need to know how to finger pick in any detail. Sorted.
Yeah.
And that was it.
You know, I think I was just more interested in synthesizers and continuing piano than like really getting into guitar, more than just like having it as something accessible. And it's so fun and like soothing to play too. But yeah, I've treated a lot of instruments like that, where I can like pick up a lot of different instruments and play to a certain extent, but I think I'm only fluent in piano or on keyboards.
You see, the great thing about software is that you can play a phrase once well, and then you don't need to play it again. Then you know, even if you want a track that has, if you want to chuck together something that's kind of like a piece of rock music or whatever, you only have to play each part once, and then you just copy them across the whole thing.
But I like the imperfections too. Sometimes I'll just play a whole track so it sounds just close to perfect, but not quite. So nice. You can tell that it's different.
Nice. You see, I'm lazy these days. So I chuck stuff out so fast that when I do start working, I work very, very quickly. Actually, this year I've been quite kind of – this year's not been a great deal, because I've only done, I think, 3 or 4 releases this year. The previous year I did something like 40-something, because I was doing this project called A Thing a Day, and I was either doing a drawing or taking a photograph or making a piece of music. And I ended up making hundreds of pieces of music. And ended up with, like, when I put them all together, because I gave them all different project names and all different band names, and when I got to the end of it, I had something like, you know, including the work I was doing on my main thing as well, I had something like 40 odd releases by the end of the year. So EPs and albums and things that were full length, there were loads of them. But this year it's been more about it's ended up really being more about the podcasting this year. Because I started doing that, and I've effectively taken a year off, really. So, you know, but that's okay. Yeah, I'm getting old, so that's right. You know, I'm going to be 41 in a few weeks, and that's...
I don't know. There are different ways of production.
Yeah.
And conversation is definitely a type of production, and I don't know.
Absolutely. And it's I think for me, it's kind of, it's, part of me kind of goes, why can't as many people listen to my music as listen to the podcast? So listeners, go and listen to my music, right? Because I can't interview myself. So,
you know, yeah, you can.
Well, I kind of almost
well,
feel
I
like
can interview you on your podcast.
You could do, yeah. Well, what do you want to know? you get one free question.
Where are you?
where am I? I am currently in the downstairs kind of dining room of my house in Bilston, just outside Wolverhampton in the West Midlands in the UK.
Wonderful.
There you go. That's the answer to the question. That was a really good interview because I was able to give a really concise answer.
No, I was thinking we could do a separate podcast, another podcast that's featuring you and your music.
Yeah, well, we'll do that then. Yeah, we'll arrange that. When you get back from Tokyo, we'll arrange that in the new year. So what's coming up next with your work, both visual and musical?
Well, I'm really looking forward to going somewhere where I have more space to go through all the media that I've recorded. I brought a field recorder here.
Nice.
And so I've recorded a lot of sounds. I'm not entirely sure what's next. I would probably like to make another album within the next 6 months.
Do you find
one?
Go on.
Oh no, sorry.
I was going to say, do you find that when you're making music, do you find that it's, it may be completely different for you, but this is my experience of it, is that I'll do the thing and I'll finish it, and then I won't think about it for a while, and I'll slowly kind of start kind of thinking about sounds over a period of time, and then after a few months or a year or whatever, I feel a little kind of tickle in my brain, sort of saying, right, you need to start thinking about making another record. But it's not that I kind of, for several months before I even start recording or doing anything with it, just the kind of, I let my subconscious kind of dictate what shape I want that record to be. So that when I start it, I've got this kind of almost visual image of what I want the record to look like, if that makes any sense. Because I think of music very visually, and I think of it in terms of, you know, the way things pass from one thing to the next. And it's almost like I can see a kind of cloudy shape of the record before I start. And I don't know how any of it's going to sound. But gradually, I wait until I've got, you know, that starts to kind of become more clear before I start then recording, because then I have an idea of what I want that record to be. I don't know if that, does that happen to you?
Yeah, to some extent. I've always noticed that for, like, installation work or visual work that I do, it's more systematic in that I'll have, and like very concept driven, where I'll have a specific idea and a concept that's pretty planned out beforehand. And then when I actually go to making it, it's kind of more about like manifesting it than like figuring it out. And then music is kind of the opposite, where it's much more, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it's just much more playful, and like it kind of develops naturally, and it's more like a process of like nurturing this thing and seeing where it grows, then, and like trying to wrangle it too and herd it and shape it as it's like becoming a thing of its own.
So do you feel, do you just start recording just to see what happens? It's almost like, okay, I'm going to make a track. I have nothing in mind as to what this is going to be. It will be what it is.
Oh, yeah. I think just like the act of practicing music and playing and recording and composing is like really key to just do daily, even if there's no like purpose for it or nothing like specific to express, and then whether or not that becomes something that I would want to use for an album or present, like there's no way of knowing until after or later, because it just becomes a thing of its own. But yeah, or it's like good to like keep that exercise. So I have those tools when I do have this like pressing need or urge to record. But like the kind of like random idle music making is, I think, just as important in a way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I thought it was interesting what you're saying about your kind of visual work. I used to get into all sorts of problems with my lecturers at art school because they used to always want me to have gone through various iterations of the piece before I came to the final work.
Right.
And always my first sketch would be almost identical to the finished piece because the way it works for me is it just pops into my brain as sorted. That's it. It just pops in fully formed and, you know, I then make it and then I move on to the next thing. And, you know, with music, it's slightly different. You know, I go in with the shape of it and then do what you do, really. Then let the track dictate itself. But there's a certain kind of overall vibe that I'm trying to... That sounds really old school, doesn't it? An overall kind of... Yeah, there's an overall vibe. You know, man, there's a vibe I'm trying to kind of create, man. You know, I'm trying to make it chill. Yeah, there's an overall kind of feeling I want to have. Or there's an right. intention there, but... In the individual pieces, I'll let them do what they want, but I'll kind of I'll maybe shove them a little to fit with the overall shape I want it to have. But with the visual art, it just popped into my head fully formed, and I'd make it, and then I'd move on to the next thing. And it used to drive my lecturers mad because they'd be like, "Well, where's all the sketches and all the work going up to it?" And I was like, "Well, there isn't any. This is it, you know." And I could see why it would annoy lecturers because it makes it harder for them to mark work. But
yeah,
you know, it's if that's how it is, that's how it is. You know,
right?
Yeah, but yeah, that's a complete aside. So anyway, obviously it's the late afternoon. Is it for you where you are?
Yeah, it's the evening. It's about 8 PM.
So I shall let you go in a moment. But if people want to find your work online, where's the best places for them to go?
Probably start at 333.biz, and that's spelled out with in words, so like THREE 33. and then that will lead to a Bandcamp. And then for visual work, CeliaRayHollander.com. And that's CeliaRayHollander.
And I will put all these links in the description of the podcast. So it'll be on the page that you can download it from, listeners. It'll be when I put up I put it on YouTube as well, but obviously there's no video. There's just a picture. And so you can listen to it, listeners, and just look at the picture and pretend the picture's moving, or not, or just go off and do something else. But I'll put the links in there as well. And so there'll be links everywhere. You'll be able to find all this stuff. So coming up next year, you're going to be doing a new record at some point in the next year. So will that be another 333 record then, yeah?
Yeah.
So is that your main project now?
Yes.
Excellent. It's very good. It's
thank it's you really so good. Much.
Yeah. I know that it was briefly mentioned before we started. I don't know. Was it mentioned before we started recording or afterwards? I can't remember. You briefly mentioned having listened to the Lucky Dragons podcast.
Oh, yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of some of kind of earlier Lucky Dragons, the kind of fractured, kind of little kind of gems of ideas. It's like, it almost seems to me that you allow it to be. Even if it's like a little small thing, you allow it to be that. You don't feel the need to kind of expand it into this huge kind of bombastic thing.
Yeah, I really, really love early Lucky Dragon, so that's great to hear.
Yeah, I have to say, I think Dark Falcon is one of my favourite albums of all time.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good. And I like what they're doing now. I have a lot of time for Luke and Sarah. I think they're really nice people. But I really like that first album because it's just this kind of... It's kind of weird. It almost makes no sense, but it's fantastic at the same time. It's like, you know, you'll go from and all the beats just go off at some point. You know?
Right.
There'll be a fraction of a beat that
like really like moments of pure excitement.
Yeah, you'll have little bits, and then
it's very abstract.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. So, and I pick up a lot of that in your stuff. So, you know, I'm glad that that's the right thing to say.
Thank you.
But it'd be awful if you went, no, I hate them. They're the worst band ever. And how dare you say they sound like
that? That album sucks.
Yeah. Oh man, that Falcon. I call it shit Falcon. It's so bad. I hate it so much. I actually have an opinion on it. So I think it's one of my favorite albums of all time. So, and I think your music reflects that, and I think that's a good thing. But having said that, I don't want people to think that your music is just like that. I think your music is unique in its own right. I've not heard anything else like it. Listen to it. what I'll do, actually, at the end of this podcast, I'll put on one of your tracks for people to hear. Which one would you like people to hear from?
Oh, man. I would like you to choose.
Okay. I might go with the first one I ever heard then, which is the first one off the second album.
So, all right.
Because I downloaded that and that was good. I actually bought these off Bandcamp, listeners, so go and buy them.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, go and buy these records because they're good. They're not expensive. $7.89 in US dollars. It's a very odd number you've gone for there, but, you know, we'll go with that. They're not expensive. Go and buy them. You know, you can't find them on download sites because, you know, that's a good thing. You can't pirate these, so go and buy them. Or you can listen to them for free online and then buy them.
Yeah, you can stream them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can stream all of them, and it's all good. So, yeah, excellent. So it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I shall let you get back to
likewise. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. What I will do is I should have actually explained this before I started the podcast. Once we've said goodbye, I'll actually still be here for about a minute. So,
all right.
So, you know, I'll talk to you after we've finished the podcast. But all that's left to say now for this podcast is thanks for listening, listeners. I hope you had a good Christmas or Easter or whenever it is that you're hearing this. But the thing is, it's out there forever. So Christmas 2020, how amazing was that? Ooh, yeah. And that thing that happened, that big event when that guy, that famous man died. That was a shocker. So and that disaster. Ooh. Terrible. I don't even know which one it is, so it might not have happened. So the end of this rather rambling and kind of woolly-headed, very tired version of this podcast, all I have to say is a future library goodbye, and we'll be back next time. Bye-bye-bye! Future Library is brought to you by petpiranha.com, where you can go and find out various things about people who we've talked about and various people who haven't been on the podcast yet, but might be in the future. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/futurelibrary1. So that's Future Library with a number one. And you can email me at alexbottom@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. Just search for Future Library there. That's it. Thanks.